For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'd be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy, chasing the fame. Playing the game, it'll be too easy. But tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore. And per usual, I am here with my co-host, Kent Strait. What's up, Kent?
I'd like to bring up two quick points before we dive into the topic.
All right.
One, 15 minutes ago, which is to say 10 minutes before I arrived at the studio, because I'm very into show prep, 15 minutes ago, I discovered that Murphy Brown is returning to CBS for a 13-episode run.
Oh, where's Dan Quayle when you need him?
And it made me—he's still alive. And it made me wonder, who are we as a people? Because where are our creators? Where are our visionaries? Because now everything from 1987 to about 95, we're bringing that back.
Roseanne's coming back.
Yep. Mad About You is coming back.
Ooh, is it?
Ugh. Yikes.
Okay. Wasn't a fan.
Not fun.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, wait. Hold on. I got to hurt
uh-oh.
Dave's mic.
Mic is off. Okay.
Yes. Go ahead, Dave. Oh.
So those are coming back.
Yeah, the X-Files came back.
Yes, it did.
Now my mic's off. Okay, now I'm on. Okay. Here
okay.
Get it together, Kent.
Professional radio. All right. So.
So those are all coming back.
The second thing I wanted to bring up is.
Wait, while we're on that point, though.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I'm about to wrap up a television show that just went off the air a few years ago that I think would be super timely to come back, even though it's only been gone for a couple of years.
Yeah.
The Newsroom.
That's not going to happen.
I know it's not going to come back, but I feel like, again, the Trump administration is the administration that keeps on giving news-wise, and I just think that show would do really well.
Too many people who matter had a hate boner for the Newsroom when it was on.
Okay. Right.
And the showrunner on the Newsroom now has an Academy Award, and it's just not going to happen.
Okay, you saying that the Newsroom got hate fucked? I'm just making sure that we're clear on this.
I would not say I didn't say that.
Okay,
I wouldn't say that.
Okay, I figure that's what happens
of
with
the
boner,
two of us. So. I am decidedly the less crude. The second thing I wanted to bring up is earlier this week, little view outside the show life. Calvin and I saw a movie which featured in a co-starring role Curtis 50 Cent Jackson. Now, the last time I had
my wife was also there. I just want to be
right,
very clear on that
now.
Statement.
Right,
there,
okay.
Right? So, not there's anything wrong with two guys seeing a movie together by themselves.
Got to leave a buffer seat.
Mm-hmm.
There was not. We actually sat next to each other.
That was actually not. He was the buffer between Calvin, between Jen and myself.
Yeah, my wife was there, so I was that buffer.
So. So Curtis 50 Cent Jackson was in a co-starring role, and my last interaction with Mr. Jackson was in 2003, when all of the cool kids, and by cool kids I mean the other 27-year-olds I hung out with at the time, would refer to, and they of course the 27-year-olds I hung out with in 2003 were exclusively blindingly white.
Okay.
And they would refer to him, I think, in an attempt to be inclusive, as 50 Cent. Now, when I saw this person on screen that I vaguely recognized, despite the extra 15 years of age and easily 50 pounds, from when he was much younger. I think I know that person, and I leaned over to Calvin in the movie, and I don't like to do this because I don't like to be the guy who talks in movies, but there were like 9 people in the room, and we were 3 of them. And I said, "Calvin, is that 50 Cent?" And Calvin says, "Do you mean Curtis 50 Cent Jackson?" As if he was a professor of English literature. And I just thought, I don't know what to do.
I do the same thing with The Rock. It's like, "Do you mean Dwayne The Rock Johnson?"
Okay.
So, I don't know. He didn't have to be a professor. We actually have professors with us.
Well, but are you going to catch the 45 Cent tour this year?
I am not.
It's 50 Cent on tour with Nickelback.
I hope not.
Sorry.
Apologize. Thank you. I was going to say apologize for that one. But, yeah.
Which is not to say I'm not going to repeat that joke later.
And the new and the new owner of Podcast Detroit, the board of directors voted him out. All right. So that being said, we are here concluding our series, Sacred Space. The first week we did an episode called "What Is Christianity." We had a fantastic panel that week. The next week we did an episode called "What Is Islam," and of course Saeed Khan from Wayne State University was back for that one. We always love having him on, and everybody else was great on that as well. And then last week we did an episode called "What Is Judaism." So the three Abrahamic faiths were featured in this series. Of course, there are many other religions, but this series would never end if we covered them all. But we did want to finish.
Saeed Khan, by the way, the only person in the history of this podcast we have ever mistakenly credited with a doctorate.
Yeah, yes. I thought he was a doctor. He's not. He's working towards that right now. I think he's focusing on intelligent design. Not intelligent design. Artificial intelligence. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Intelligence was in the word.
Right.
but one is intelligent and one is not. Anyhow, that's beside the point. We can get into that later. We wanted to finish out this series by bringing in people who are skeptical of faith or don't have faith in a supernatural world whatsoever. And so this particular episode is called "Not Applicable, Skepticism in a Believing World." And so we've invited on 6 people. We have a full house, which is great. And so I'm going to go ahead and read their bios. And we have just revamped our website, leadingquestionsnow.com. And so we are doing truncated bios because bios have taken up way too much time in the past. So we've got shorter bios, and if you want to read the full bios, you can go to the website. So real quick.
We have replaced the bio time in the podcast with movie anecdotes and that happened adventure earlier in the week.
So first up, we have welcoming back to the line Dr. Ethan Eagle. Dr. Ethan Eagle is an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. He holds a PhD in aerospace engineering from the University of Michigan. Dr. Eagle, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back.
Next up, everybody else? Nope. One more person has been here before, but the other 3 have not been here. So Dr. Ryan, can you pronounce your last name for me?
Fancelo.
Okay. Dr. Ryan Fancelo is a senior lecturer in the Department of Philosophy at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. Ryan does research that focuses on questions regarding the justification of moral beliefs. Ryan is an atheist. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Next up, we have Dr. Travis Figg. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. And I actually, quick fun fact, I actually got to present in Dr. Figg's class yesterday at Wayne State University. That was
indeed
a lot of fun.
You did.
So,
thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for coming back. One good turn deserves another, right? So Dr. Travis Figg is part-time faculty in the philosophy department at both Wayne State University in Detroit and Schoolcraft College in Livonia, Michigan. He possesses a PhD in philosophy from Wayne State University, an MA in philosophy from Cleveland State University, and a BA in philosophy and religious studies from Westminster College. Dr. Figg, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
This will be the only time I'm calling you all doctor. I'm going to start using your first name once we get into the conversation. Next up.
I would like to point out I have a doctorate in philosophy in aerospace engineering.
Oh.
And you all have doctorates in philosophy in philosophy.
In philosophy.
Okay.
Which is funny to me.
It's interesting.
Probably no one else.
I will laugh as if it is funny. I don't know why. So next up, we have welcoming back to the line, and he's probably going to lie some way, shape, or form.
As he is.
During this podcast.
One of history's great liars.
Mr. Rick Goldberg is back. Rick Goldberg is a Michigan native. He holds a BA from Michigan State University with a major in criminal justice. I'm sure you were pretty happy with everything that came down. Some criminal justice came down today because of what happened at Michigan State University. He recently retired from the Michigan Department of Corrections following a 30-year career having served as an officer, sergeant, counselor, unit manager, captain, inspector, and assistant deputy warden. Rick is an atheist. Rick, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Next, we have Mr. E.L. McCullers. E.L. McCullers is the writer and illustrator for the comic book 25 Ways to Say No. He possesses a B.A. in film from Grand Valley State University. He publishes two ongoing comic books and teaches kids to write and draw cohesive stories. E.L. believes that belief that is mutually exclusive is limiting. E.L., thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And last but not least, the man who needs no introduction, so let's move on. No. last but not least, Mr. David Phillips is back on the show. I guess so we had three who had been here. David Phillips has over 20 years in information technology, despite the biochemistry and theater arts degrees. He is the owner of Podcast Detroit, where you're broadcasting right now, and hosts the popular podcast IT and the D. David, atheist or agnostic? I'm not sure.
A little column A, a little column B.
Little column – okay. All right. So this is going to be an interesting conversation. That being said, let's jump right into questions. And obviously, we tried to keep a lot of the questions the same when we had people who believed in the supernatural world. But the questions are going to be decidedly different this time around. So first question, I guess, will be a little similar though. When and why did you become an atheist or an agnostic? Was it – you're always raised that way, or was there kind of a journey out of faith? And we don't have to go in any particular order, but please say your name first time you speak.
Well, I'm Rick. I'm pretty sure I always was an atheist, even though I grew up in a Jewish family. I never really had a feeling for God, any type of deity. I do remember when I was 14, when the rabbi was up at the pulpit talking about the need to move out of Detroit, so we needed to raise funds for a temple in the suburbs, which sent a message to me that maybe I don't need to be part of this group.
Okay.
I guess this is Dave. I mean, I was raised in a very Catholic family, and kind of the same thing that Rick was just saying. I mean, I never felt it. I mean, I wasn't kicked out of Catholic school. I was, however, invited not to re-enroll for the following year. because I asked too many questions.
We're not firing you.
We're just not going to pay you anymore. And
you can keep coming.
Out of the building.
Yeah. We're going in a different direction.
But, I mean, so, you know, to me it was, you know, that was kind of where, well, you know, if you can't stand up to questions, and then I started asking more questions, and it's just kind of where I wound up as a person. You know, and then, like, you know, like you mentioned, you know, the biochem background and science and everything else, it just, it's kind of who I became.
Okay.
So I'm kind of with you on the questions thing. Like, I was always that kid who had too many questions. Oh, EL. Yep. My father built churches for a living, so I got to talk to I got to see the business side of it, which totally separated from the spiritual side for me. And then, like, Sunday schools and stuff like that, I was the kid who asked the questions and made the teacher leave the room to get someone else. And it just kind of equaled this thing over time where I realized that the questions were kind of more important than the answers, because the answers weren't always answers. And if I believe a wrong answer, then I may stop asking the right questions. And so I just kind of live in that space.
Okay.
Hallelujah. This is Ethan. I did a little prep trying
who's
to
– Ethan, who's been in the room for 5 minutes, and he's already crying out to God with praise.
So the obvious – I mean, I think there's a lot of fun to be had personally in pushing religious boundaries. I grew up Catholic. I was a Catholic altar boy. Spent a lot of time in church. But I think this question is best asked – analogous form, which is like, when did I stop collecting stamps? Right? Like, I've never been a stamp collector. I see other people with stamp collecting as a hobby, and I'm like, great, good. That's a nice thing that you have that brings you fulfillment. I have no interest in that line of in hanging out with those people or seeing that. And so every opportunity I had growing up to like really collect my first stamp and understand what other people seemed to be experiencing when they went to church, I never got one. I just like this. I had too many questions that couldn't be answered with something that drove me to see that this form of inquiry was leading somewhere profitable. And so I got drawn out in college in a philosophy class, probably by an atheist philosophy professor who challenged my then belief in God, as not really my belief, but just beliefs that had been passed on to me. And it wasn't a watershed moment. I didn't lose the faith. It was a recollection that I had never gathered any rosebuds.
Okay.
This is Ryan. I am the rare atheist that was raised by atheists, so I'm a little self-conscious about it. I don't feel like I have the atheist cred that other atheists had. I didn't have the coming out party to the parents or anything like that, but yeah, I was raised by atheists.
Okay. That's like the kid who's raised a Christian and it's testimony time, and then one guy's like, I killed people, and then Jesus pulled me out of the ditch, and you're like, well, I was raised in a good Christian home. Thanks, everybody. But, I mean, that's still legit. And you're the first person I've met who was actually raised by atheists who's an atheist himself. So that's, I mean, the first person I've met. I'm sure there are plenty. But that's unique to me. So
it's unique. When atheists get together, not that we have conventions or anything, but when I talk to other atheists, it's often a topic of conversation. When did you realize that you didn't – or when did you tell your parents you didn't believe in God, and what was that like? And I don't have that experience. I also you know, inevitably you question if you believe what your parents believe. Like, do I just believe this because my parents believed it? If you're Christian, you might wonder, would I be Muslim or atheist if my parents were Muslim or atheist? A lot of atheists don't struggle with that because they say, look, I saw through it. But I do struggle with that. Maybe I would be very religious had my parents been different.
Okay.
You know, that's similar to the Unitarian Universalist. I belong to that particular congregation, which is pretty secular. And most of the members came to the faith, so to speak, from other religious viewpoints. But every once in a while, you run to one that's my age that said, yeah, I was raised by Unitarian Universalists, which is very unusual.
This is Travis. I was fairly religious in high school, and I moved towards agnosticism in college and graduate school. Basically, I studied reasons for and against believing in God, and I studied different religious traditions, and I became humble about my ability to know the truth in these areas.
Okay. I'll share mine. I mean, obviously, I'm not atheist.
You were for about an hour and a half in January.
Yeah, I was. Okay. I had an abscess tooth, and Trump was president. So it was pretty rough month. But no, interestingly, the question thing took me the other direction. So my background is obviously in religious thought, and I'm currently working on a master's degree at Biola University in La Mirada, California, and the degree is in Christian apologetics, which are reasonable defenses for the Christian faith. So you have questions. A lot of people assume that there aren't answers, but the questions are still there. And there are sometimes answers, and a lot of answers, a lot more answers than people assume. And so I was also that kid, though, who would drive the Sunday school teacher, you know, out of the room. It's like, oh, hey, kids, it's Noah's Ark. Oh, this is a story about a floating zoo. And I was a kid like, it's also a story about mass xenocide. I'm like, Calvin, you're four. Why do you know the word xenocide? I'm like, because I'm smart as hell. But God killed everybody on the planet. Those are big questions that I'm asking about.
You know, I'm very smart, too. And I just learned the word xenocide 25 seconds ago. Never heard it in my life.
My mom was an English teacher. She had one of those word of the day calendar type things, the rip-offs. Huh. But for me, my questions drove me to want to explore all the religions. I wanted to explore Judaism and Islam. I wanted to know, am I accepting this because my parents, you know, handed this down to me? But and then also I dabbled with atheism for a little bit. I was like, I was still within the Christian fold when that happened, but I still wanted to know, okay, is this okay? And that gave my parents a little bit of pause. Like, should you be studying the Quran? Like, are we being good parents by letting him study that? Are we being good parents by letting him study Judaism? And they only got half the story, right? So that kind of deal. But atheism was, I mean, my mom has straight up told me, you know, I would rather you be gay than atheist, because if you're gay, there's still a chance that you can repent. But if you're an atheist, there's no coming back from that. It's like, I don't know why there's no coming back from that. I can get convinced with evidence.
That doesn't seem logically sound.
But that's her fear, right? And that's the fear of a lot of Christians. That's not the first. She's not the first person who's shared that sentiment. But for me, my questions drove me to research deeply religious questions about this world and this life. And I found that Christianity did have it. Christianity specifically did have answers to the questions that I was asking, not just the questions that I was asking, the questions that other people were asking, and the question that people down through the millennia have been asking. And so that's kind of been my journey in terms of asking questions and dealing with my own skepticism, but you guys have gone a different direction. And so I want to dive into some of that. So we'll let Kent, if you want to share your journey, or we can go right into the next question.
I mean, it's not much of a journey. I'm that kid with the crappy testimony around the campfire.
You two are polar opposites, right?
I'm the antichrist. I guess the only journey I have is that, you know, we talked earlier about coming out as an atheist to Christian or Catholic or even Muslim or Jewish parents, and I haven't had a coming out experience, but the last 10 years there has been a great separation, a great and increasing separation between what I believe the nature and expectations of God to be versus all the people I grew up with, and the church that they're still a part of. So sometimes it feels like a different religion, but it's on paper the same.
Okay.
So beyond being a lack of belief in the supernatural or belief in the knowability of God, what are some of the central tenets of atheism or agnosticism? What makes atheism, agnosticism, the rational position in a world where the majority of people believe in some form of supernaturalism?
Can I just answer the first question? I just tend to think of atheism as the view that God does not exist and it has no tenets beyond that. So an atheist could think a wide range of other things. There are atheists, and I wouldn't encourage this, but there are atheists who believe in ghosts and astrology, right? And there are atheists who think that the scientific worldview is too narrow, and there are atheists who really embrace the scientific worldview. So I like the minimal characterization of atheism, really no tenets other than you don't believe in God.
I guess it's kind of like saying, so you don't believe in Santa. What are the tenets of that belief?
Exactly.
There are none.
That is an excellent analogy.
Santa's not real.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and I think that's the key point right there. It's not accepting things based on faith. It's prove it. I think that's the, I'm not going to accept something just because someone says I should without some rationale behind that.
I think too many people have the idea that atheism is anti-theism, and it's not. It's just, I don't believe. It's pretty simplistic.
Well, is it? And I think some of the grr factor that comes with it is, especially where we are as a society today, it's not okay to just be okay with things anymore. You have to be so over the top supportive of whatever something is, or it's break out the pitchforks and torches.
I don't think it's just current. It's always been that way. Yeah, you wouldn't have the Reformation or the Inquisitions. Those aren't exactly new or different.
Yeah.
But being an atheist, you're off to one side.
So Rick, you mentioned atheist versus anti-theist. There are some. I guess what we usually use the term is militant atheists, angry, passionate, over-the-top atheists, evangelical atheists even. So would you say that's a different category, that they're more anti-theist as opposed to atheist?
Again, I think it's just too simplistic of a concept. I mean, mostly when atheists react when it's pushback. The requirements that, you say the Ten Commandments in school, some senator somewhere in some state just pushing that today. Leave me alone. That's pretty much the concept. If you don't leave me alone, then I'm going to have to discuss and explain why I don't want to have anything to do with it. But, I hate to say it, but some of my best friends are Christians.
I hate saying that, too.
Okay, yeah.
This is Ethan. I think, for me, being an atheist is just the lack of a dogma. I don't have any beliefs that I am unwilling to question. And in the light of new evidence or compelling evidence, I'm willing to change any thought that I have to be true if I'm presented with evidence that proves my position to be indefensible.
Which seems to me that's consistent with your training as a scientist. That if compelling evidence for God showed up, you wouldn't reject it out of hand.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
But wouldn't the question be, like, how? I mean, if you're a, let's say you're a naturalist or materialist, right? All you believe in is the material world. There's going to be a philosophical commitment. And let's not pretend that science doesn't have philosophical commitments. And we'll get to that on the back half of the show. But so I guess put this in the back pocket. If there is a philosophical commitment to everything being matter, everything being natural, there is no supernatural. Would there be any type of compelling proof for the miraculous, right? You can't believe in miracles as a naturalist or a materialist. So even if God did show up, you'd be like, well, I don't have an answer for it, but science is going to have an answer for it at some point, right? For that phenomenon that just happened. There's some way to explain this. So isn't it fair to say that there are certain commitments you have philosophically as a scientist committed to naturalism, materialism, or scientism?
Can I butt in here? So I think there's an important distinction between two kinds of naturalists. So one kind of naturalism you might have in the philosophical literature is called methodological naturalism. You say, what I should believe is what my evidence best supports. And most methodological naturalists right now are probably atheists. But in principle, if God existed, I would say – if there was some great evidence for God's existence, then I would believe in God. If God was the best explanation for something, I would believe in it. There's also metaphysical naturalism or as you said, materialism, which is the view that everything is matter. Those two views might travel together. I might be a materialist because I'm a methodological naturalist, but they can come apart. I might think right now the evidence favors materialism, but in the future it might not. And so if God showed up and said, you know, Ryan, I'm real. I'm going to make it rain frogs out, and it starts raining frogs, I would start saying, oh, I guess I was wrong. There is a God, and that would be consistent with my methodological naturalism, and I would just give up the materialism.
Okay. All right. That's a fair answer. But still, thoughts on this question? Does everybody else kind of align with this? Hey, simple, it's just a no belief in God?
Yeah. So I'm agnostic, and all that means is I don't know whether there's a God or not. I don't have a strong claim there. That's kind of the bare minimum of it. For me, it's connected to this openness to be willing to consider arguments for and against, to consider points of view that I haven't thought about before, and maybe my mind will be changed. I'm open to that. But the agnosticism itself, at the bare minimum, it's just, I don't know.
Okay.
This is EO. There's a few different ways for me to see atheism. I don't necessarily think I'm an atheist, but according to some people, I am, because they define God differently. So it becomes a question of a language, really. Like, there's a bunch of different religions where I'm like, I think you guys are praising the same God. And they're like, no, we aren't. Okay. So I don't know what that really would mean as far as how do you determine if you are. Like, and then there's atheists who are mad at God, which doesn't make any sense because you don't believe in it, right? Or is that your way of being mad? You like, I don't believe in you, which means you believe. So I don't know where any consistency exists for it. And even if it did, I think just the language of the way that people talk about these sort of things creates a, like, based on the way you talk about this, someone could believe that they believe the exact same thing as you,
mm-hmm.
or recognize that there's no way that anyone believes the same thing, even if they are in the same organized religion. There's just certain things that meet up for them that they would agree on. But I think if anybody goes into enough depth and talks about enough of their own personal experience, they realize that they are in their own separate religion, everyone.
I'm glad you brought up the it's kind of elephant in the room for a lot of Christians, I think, the, hey, you're mad at God kind of thing. And unfortunately, that's like a pushback that a lot of Christians will say to atheists, which I think is disingenuous most of the time when it's said, oh, you're just really mad at God. That being said, there are plenty of people who, unfortunately, have a wrong view of God to begin with. And I'm talking about people who have been mad at the Christian conception of God. I don't mean a lot of Muslims who are super mad at God and become atheists. That might be the case. I don't mean a lot of Jews who are mad at God and then become atheists. That might be the case. But from my own camp, it's people who are like, who have a view of God as Santa Claus. I asked for a pony for Christmas. I didn't get it. God doesn't exist.
Or a example from my real life. It was my first the first time that I was aware of atheism came when I was 19. I mean, yeah, that seems late. But you know, raised by Christians, raised in the church.
Late bloomer. We got
my my best friend in high school, Christian Evangelical Baptist High School. He went to it was our freshman year in college, and he told me over the phone one night during his freshman year that he did not believe in God. And in talking to him, he said, because my grandma was diagnosed with stomach cancer, and I prayed that she would get better, and she died. She was 89, by the way, and so God is not real, which makes me think, of course, his faith was a micron deep the whole time, but that was the first time I was aware of the mad at God atheism.
Yeah, but I wouldn't characterize the majority of atheists that I meet as the angry type of atheist. But Kent did mention that there are some who are militant and almost evangelical in their anti-theism. It is straight up anti-theism. I mean, the early 2000s were characterized by a slew of books that came out: "God Is Not Great," "Good Without God," and a host of others. And so some skeptics are critical of religion, and rightly so. There is a lot of abuses in a lot of religions, and a lot of Christians in the early 2000s and up till now have said, all right, yep, we got it wrong there. How can we fix that? But then there were some things we're like, I don't know if that argument holds water. So that being said, some are also all right with kind of the placebo effect it may have for others. I mean, as you were saying, hey, you know what? If you want to do your thing, your stamp collecting thing over there, you know, that's good for you. But
your philatelism.
Your what?
Philatelism.
Is that a
stamp collecting?
Really? Okay. Mm-hmm. You are. That's why you're.
How do you not know the word xenocide?
I know. That doesn't know. Everybody's got their niche.
some are critical. And some are okay with the placebo effect of religion as long as it doesn't harm anybody, right? Do you believe religion, organized or otherwise, is helpful or problematic? Why or why not?
I mean, I think it's helpful if it depends on the person's motivation. If the person is motivated by consequence and they need consequence beyond the material world, then if that's what's making them do great things, then do great things. If the person is just motivated by, you know, they've defined themselves as a person who does nice things, mm-hmm. for other people, and that's their only motivation they need, then that's cool. It doesn't – I don't know. I'm kind of interested in the end result more, mm-hmm. than anything. So it doesn't matter what your process is, to me at least.
Well, I mean, you're answering the question on a personal level, and I think most people would, but – How would you answer that? How would you answer the question on group dynamic, kind of deal?
So,
because a religion's not a person by themselves. A religion is a group of people who have agreed to the same kind of tenets and beliefs, and we're going to do this thing together.
Which is why I would say I don't have a religion, mm-hmm. but I believe in God, but I don't believe in the God as defined by most people, so I am kind of in my own religion. Actually, I guess that was what I was saying before, is everyone is in their own religion. There's just these different, like, have you ever had a conversation with someone and you're so sure that what you're saying makes sense that you think they agree with it, but they don't?
It's a marriage.
You've met my marriage. <Yeah. laughs>
Yes, I am married.
It eventually falls apart when you go into enough detail. Mm-hmm. I think everything will do that. Well, maybe not astrophysics.
I think about political organizational philosophy as well, as in the same camp as this. And it's like, if there is a world where these doctrines had never been developed – and we just had a materialist rationalist view of the world, what would we be missing? And I ask that question, and I don't feel like I would be missing a whole lot. But I see other people who have are steeped in the faith, and they clearly would be missing out. And that's, I mean, that's why I don't feel like I'm missing the party. There's some cool party happening, and I'm standing outside, but I'm like, I don't want to go to that party. And so for me, would it be better if there were if that party didn't exist? Like, I think those people would come join this other party. I don't think that there's anything wrong with what I do believe in. But there's no way to go back in time and undo the fact that there are many multitude of world religions and many of them disagree on basic premises. Would it be better if there weren't religious wars? I think the answer is yes. Would there be wars over other seemingly illogical things? Probably. So there's some element of human nature that to me suggests an organizational principle of things that we think we all agree on but actually don't at some deeper level. That's a useful I mean, it's tribalism to me. And whether or not tribalism is good or bad, I think depends on the dogma with which it's executed. So, are you a good Christian? Then I'm cool. If you're a militant Christian, militant atheist, dogmatic of any faith, then we have problems.
Okay.
Yeah, the circumstances are important too. You know, I was at a funeral the other day, and everyone has the shared idea at this particular funeral, and they're all praying to the same God, and they're all talking about, you're in God's hands now, and there's comfort. And I have no problem with religion if you're there for the comfort, for the traditions and the culture, and it offers you comfort. That's great. Doesn't do anything for me. But if it makes you happy, fine.
See, I'm always surprised when an atheist tells me that, because atheists, by and large, when the rhetoric comes out especially, consider themselves rational. And to call oneself rational is to assume that the opposite position, by and large, is irrational. And my thought is, if someone's saying, hey, you know what, he's in God's hands now and it gives you comfort, if it's an irrational thought, if it's an irrational belief to hold, even if it gives you comfort, why does it make sense to just let people go on believing that thing?
If it's not causing you any harm or anyone else any harm, it's fine.
I'm in the same boat. I mean, I think that's one of the big disconnects there, is that there's a difference between being an atheist or being agnostic and being violently against something, you know. And I think that's, you know, kind of the perception that I was getting at earlier. It's no different. You know what? You want to carry a rabbit's foot because you think it brings you good luck and you're all in. Cool.
Sure, but the person holding the rabbit's foot is not going into the voting booth and saying because of this rabbit's foot, I don't want to have to serve you a birthday cake or a wedding cake.
Well, but that's a whole different dynamic, and that gets into this is where, to me, it's not even so much religion that I've ever had an issue with; it's organized religion, and that's the reality. Because, you know, to me, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think we could, even in this room, we could all agree there are always forces at work that we don't understand, mm-hmm. whether they be electromagnetical, whether they be, you know, whatever, that are out there. So, you know, the saying, you know, believing that there may be a higher power of some sort that we don't get, cool. But it's the – when you start deep diving, and I think you do that in some of the later questions, that's where I have my issues, is when people start picking and choosing. Because to me, you're either all in or you're all out. And we've had this discussion before,
right,
where, you know, okay, you can't say, all right, like Calvin, case in point, you're a religious guy. You're getting your master's. You got tattoos, dude. How's that line up with the Old Testament?
I can tell you exactly how it lines up with the Old Testament. But
I'm just saying.
I'm going to go.
I mean, no.
But
I guess the question is, you go to a funeral, you know, oh, Janice died, she's with God now. And that's great, and everybody feels good, and they have a big meeting afterward, and they have a little potluck, and they remember Janice's life, right? But then they go home, and that belief that Janice is in heaven with God now comes from the same belief system that says, yeah, gay people are an abomination. And so why wouldn't you want to obliterate – I mean, yeah, it might make you feel comfortable because Janice – is gone and you want to feel good that there's an afterlife, but it's also causing harm over here. So it might be fine right in this moment, but ultimately it's part of a larger set of ideas that do hurt people. Well, and so if
what if I mean, there's so many other religions and belief systems that have some sort of an afterlife. How do you know that you aren't just agreeing with that?
That's
you know
a good question.
I mean? Like, I mean, it's I would just be generalizing. Like, yeah, she if that exists, then she's somewhere better or worse or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's just an idea. Like everything is just mental anyway. I mean, everything is just. We just construct these concepts, and so I mean, why shouldn't we construct concepts that work well? I don't have a problem with being irrational. I should probably say that first.
I've understood this.
Yeah,
we've had a lot of conversations in the past.
Because, like I said, it comes down to what is the end result you want, and I mean, for a lot of people, a religion, any religion, will give them purpose. If you've decided on a purpose outside of that, then you're still on a quest to get to an end result that matches up with that. So what do the details matter? Like when he's with people who are like, she's in a better place, I mean, he can agree with that without it being related to their religion, because there's other religions that believe that. So like, that's what I meant when I was saying, like, it's really nonspecific. You can just, you being rational, a lot of the time we make decisions, then we rationalize them anyway. But a lot of people don't want to think about things that way. They want to believe that their beliefs are not based on what they want to believe, but what they should be believing. And should isn't even really a real thing. Should is still a mental construct. So, I mean...
Well, I guess I'm being very pragmatic and very specific here. So let's use this analogy real quick. Let's say that you have a neighbor, and he allows you to borrow... his lawnmower, but every morning he also slashes your tires, mm-hmm. right? So he's a nice neighbor sometimes, but an asshole every single morning to you. That would be, the borrowing a lawnmower would be, hey, that belief, she's in a better place. The asshole part would be slashing your tires. And both of those beliefs are coming, both of those things are coming from that same person. They're coming from that same neighbor.
I don't have to borrow his lawnmower. There's other lawnmowers. That's my point.
So what I'm saying is, all right, let's say you found a religion that didn't do those things. Mm-hmm. Better place. Everything's cool. They're all great.
That would be the religion you made up. Your religion.
No, I'm saying, what if there's another religion over here? And I'm very specifically addressing Christianity at this point, because I'm part of this religion. I've seen it happen. So there are people who believe this person's in heaven, and at the same time they're going to vote to make sure that gay people can't live in certain areas, that black people can't live in certain areas or be married to a white person. So there are very real implications and very real results that come from a specific set of beliefs, or beliefs that people believe that their deeply held beliefs are coming from this particular set of beliefs. So if you had a religion that didn't do those things, fine, support it. But if you are a rational person and you see damage going on, why would you allow that to go on just because it makes someone feel better? Because it's doing a lot of damage otherwise.
I would use the example of your tattoos. So there's some Christian out there who's like, he's not a Christian because he has these tattoos. So it once again comes down to just language. Are you something different than they are? Probably.
My understanding is every Calvin's single not individual? An Orthodox Jew because he has the tattoos, but I think Christianity-wise, he's okay.
There are some in Christianity who would definitely see it wrong. They are incorrect, but that's
but they don't know they're incorrect.
Well, correct. But correct. So, and I think that's the thing. Correct. You get into, and this is where I get into my it's organized religion I have an issue with, because it's almost like listening to somebody rationalize themselves into, I am an anti-gun, pro-choice Republican. No, you're not. You're not. That's not being a Republican. Oh, okay. You know, that's not how that works. You know, so I am that's to me, that's always been the fundamental issue with organized religion with me, is that everything that I see coming out of it is, well, I like this, but I don't like that. OK, well, then you're not really that, because if you're branding yourself as a Christian, this is what you believe, or as a Catholic, this is what you believe. And that is what you've aligned yourself with. And if that's not what you want to align yourself with, then don't.
Okay.
Just riffing off of what EL said, the idea that you have a belief system and then you rationalize it. I mean, I guess I've always thought that Christians and Muslims and people of faith believe with they have rational reasons for believing. And if that's not true, then I really don't understand why people believe.
You should listen to the rest of this series.
Yeah. So I'm just when somebody, you know, if somebody believes that you shouldn't allow gay people to get married, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, that must be because they don't want everyone to go to hell, right? They want it, like your mother who said, well, you can be saved right at the very end. Maybe if that's the case, like it's not too late to push you out of the way of the bus.
Right.
That like we're going to save you somehow. And that's to me always been the confusing part about religion, is that people don't seem to be wanting to push me out of the way of the bus. They're just like, yeah, whatever, you're
you know, it this isn't what this podcast is about, but just something Ethan said made me think. As somebody who has been in the Christian church my entire life, the irony of the gay marriage debate is that I can construct, assuming Christianity is true, it is not difficult to construct a rational argument that homosexuality is bad. But I can't construct an argument that gay marriage is bad. They're different things.
True story. Let's move on, though.
Yeah.
Next question. Actually, go to five.
Okay. Let's talk about reason. The laws of logic, the laws of contradiction, the law of executed, the law of excluded middle, the law of identity are neither material things nor mere conceptions of the human mind. They are fixed, immaterial, eternal laws. The materialist or the atheist may use the laws of logic, but can they account for where they come from?
I like how you guys just like snuck in the hardest question in all of philosophy on here. let me say this.
And
about,
right before the break.
Yeah. Let me say this about the question. It's a hard question. You know, nobody agrees about what the answer is. But I guess it's a common thing atheists are asked, like, where do the laws of logic or where do the laws of morality come from? And I think the proper response is that's a really hard question. Sometimes when I'm talking to theists about these things, I say, where do you think they come from? And often the theist says, I have no idea. And I'm like, neither do I. All right. Sometimes they do give explanations, and oftentimes those explanations don't appeal to God at all. And I say, no, I could accept that explanation. It's interesting. I'll think about it more. Sometimes they kind of appeal to God incidentally, and I think, okay, I agree with most of what you said except for the part about God. I don't know that God is going to really help us in understanding that. So look, it's a hard problem. Where do the laws of logic come from? What's their metaphysical status? There's lots of theories. No one knows the answer. But I don't see any reason why the theist is better off here. It seems to me it's a hard problem for everyone.
Well, I think the issue for atheists on this particular question is it's almost like a pushback from theists, because theists will often use God to prove God, right? Like that's just circular reasoning. You're using God to prove God. You're starting with the conclusion, ending up at the conclusion, but not putting anything in the middle. It's like God, therefore God, right? And so it doesn't make any sense. And so the laws of logic, being immaterial, being eternal, using reason to defend reason to the theist seems circular for a person who can't defend where they come from. Right, so if you're saying I can't defend where God comes from, that's how the theist views things. Like, hey, where did God come from? Oh, I don't. Well, okay, uncaused cause, blah blah blah. Right, that's kind of that pushback on that. All right, you're using the laws of logic. You're saying we're rational, we're reasonable. You're using these laws, and you have no idea where they come from. Well, that's a really hard question. So it's the same thing.
Can I ask you, as a theist, where do you believe the laws of logic come from?
I believe the laws of logic are rooted in God. It's going to be another 4-hour podcast to talk about that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I do believe that that's the pushback question, is like, how can atheists use reason to defend reason when they would say that a theist using God to defend God is circular reasoning? Isn't it circular reasoning? Isn't it pragmatic to admit that it's circular reasoning and just have to go with it?
So this is Ethan. To me, there's a simple and trite answer to this, which is everything that we're talking
about. Ethan's about to solve it. All right, we got
this
it.
Is not a, this is not a, this is the kid in the back of the class making a point, not contributing really materially to the discussion. We invented this. That's, I mean, we invented the laws of reason and logic, and they aren't eternal without humankind. There might be aliens who have better logic than we do, but that we're never, I mean, in a conception of a God who does understand where all this stuff comes from, if we can't conceive of where it comes from, then we don't have that status.
Well, that doesn't make any sense, because the law of non-contradiction is going to... The law of non-contradiction is going to be the law of non-contradiction, whether we're here to perceive it or not.
Wait, how is that eternal, though? Like, I mean... Okay,
Schrodinger's so let's say the universe stops existing. Let's say the universe explodes, right? Mm-hmm. So the universe does not exist and exist at the same time. It just doesn't.
How do you know that?
Basic logic. It's like the first rule
of
logic.
You don't know how the universe works, though. So how can you know?
Do we know how the universe works, Ethan?
Can you empirically prove we're not in the Matrix?
No, I cannot. But now you're talking conspiracy theories, right?
Well, no, but I mean, so that's the thing. I mean, and I think that's kind of the foundation of this is, and what you were just saying is I'm not going to let you use faith to prove faith. But yeah, I'll use science to prove science.
All I'm going to say is that if something is true, A, then A. Yes. Like that's that if A is true, true, then true. That's fine. Where does the truth come from? That is the underlying question for me. And truth does not come from outside of this room. It does not come from outside of what and we. Hopefully, we're going to get into this moral relativism mm-hmm. versus realism. But to me, what is true is all we can. It's what we can account for. So if we can say if true, then true. Then we've proven it to ourselves, and that's all that I – it doesn't matter beyond that.
Okay.
I was thinking about water bearers earlier today and how if you tried to tell – like even someone who just only uses empirical methods, you tried to explain this creature to them like 200 years ago, it would be a paradox. It wouldn't, like to them, it wouldn't make sense. They would not believe that could happen. Like it just wouldn't make sense to them at all. For what we know, and even what we know now, it doesn't fully go with, like how, what some, when you think
about. But you're talking about perception of reality, not reality itself.
But perception of reality is reality because you can only perceive it. There's no one outside of reality. I mean, that's the purpose of God, right? Is that you have contact with someone outside of reality who can tell you what reality is because you can only perceive reality.
Is that true?
Everyone can only perceive what they believe to be true. Now,
is that true? I'm going to keep asking you that question.
Well, remember, you're dealing with a guy who doesn't think anything is necessarily true or false.
But is that true?
It might be. I don't know. That's
now,
the whole
now
idea.
You're being my 6-year-old.
No. I mean, no, but that's the idea. Like, soon as you think you know things, you are wrong because there's always going to be a part of it
is that
you don't
true?
Know.
Is that true?
I don't know. That's the whole point. I mean, I see what you're.
I mean, are we communicating? Like, if you're saying as soon as you know something, I mean, you're right now. You are making a truth statement. I am claiming to know something,
which
and
destroys.
That is to say, when you know something, it's automatically false. Well, is that true?
No, it's not automatically false. It automatically could be false. I'm just saying that there is, you can't say something. I can't say that A is A, or maybe I can say A is A, but I will never really know if A is A. I just know I believe that A is A. But if I don't actually believe it because I know that I shouldn't necessarily believe it, then I'm closer to the reality of it, which is I can never truly know.
I believe he's saying if A, then A, right? Until proven otherwise, A, then A.
But he's saying he can't know it.
But I'm assuming that otherwise exists at all times.
See,
no, but
the difference between you and I is that I believe that truth is knowable. You don't.
No, I don't think anything is knowable. Like, I think just the fact that people talk about God like they understand it discredits the idea of something that would be a God.
Who's got some weed?
Can I ask the philosophy professors here, though, then? How can we have a conversation if truth isn't knowable in any real sense?
Could I back up to the original question?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a presumption behind the question is that the laws of logic have to come from somewhere. And I just reject that assumption. Let's look at the law of non-contradiction. The basis of the law of non-contradiction is that there being a table here, I don't care whether there really is or not. If there's a table here, there doesn't fail to be a table here. Part of it, what if is for there to be a table here is that there's not a table here. That's it. That doesn't have to come from anything else. So the whole idea that laws of logic have to come from something is just a mistake.
Okay. So can I ask the question then for the existence of God, can that not be the same answer?
Can I push back on that? So I think it's true. Everyone starts from some assumptions, right?
Are you pushing back on me or on him?
I'm pushing back on you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Everyone starts from some assumptions, right?
Right.
So why the laws of logic? Why not God? Here's the thought. The assumptions we start with should be explanatorily fruitful. And the laws of logic are fruitful if anything is. Arithmetic does not get off the ground if you don't start with the laws of logic. You can't do any science. So that earns its keep by being explanatory fruitful. And then I ask, is the same thing true of God? Does God earn his keep by being explanatorily fruitful? If yes, I'll believe in him. If not, no. Now, my current position is no. As Ethan said, I'm open to questioning anything. So if you can show me, oh, I can explain so much good stuff with God, then I would believe in God. But I think my current position is laws of logic, wow, I couldn't do any math or any science without them. Explanatorily fruitful, earn their keep, if anything. God doesn't seem to explain too much, so I think I'm going to leave that one out. That's kind of my take on it.
Okay, fair enough. All right, I think that's a good place to take a break. We're going to take a break for about 10 minutes, and we will be back. Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for waiting on the line. We are back from break. Let's talk about science.
Okay.
We're not going to talk about science. Thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin. No. What questions does science answer about the world? And what questions does science by its nature not answer? And I'll kick this over to Ethan and David first. I'd like to know your guys' perspective as people who have majored in some hard sciences, so to speak.
Yeah, sure. So this is Ethan. How is it that is a good question to answer with a scientific method? How is it that the sky is blue? How is it that I can turn gasoline into motive force that'll push my car down the road? That I can do some inquiry, I can gather some data, and I can determine how it is that these things exist in the world. Why did I evolve this way, if I believe in evolution? Why are we here? These are philosophical questions that science doesn't address.
Okay.
I'm right there with you. I mean, when I go with what questions does science answer, I guess my follow-up question is, well, okay, what doesn't it answer? If you look at it from a truly empirical point of view, I don't know that there are too many questions that can't. Well, not that there aren't too. There are questions.
What doesn't it answer yet?
Yeah.
Question.
True.
I think people are looking for purpose generally, and that's pretty much the only, like, the questions. I guess you could have the questions just out of curiosity, but a lot of time these questions are to get an end result, and that end result in the end comes down to being rooted in some sort of a belief in a purpose, whether that purpose is serving others and improving society, or if it just make if like there it's purpose that it doesn't answer, but that's something I've always tried to decide, am I overthinking when I think about purpose? Does there need to be anything beyond experience? Like, am I taking experience for granted as if it is not enough? Does there have to be a purpose?
So I think maybe an interesting analogy here would be, like, science is figuring out what are the rules of the game? How do I advance my piece along the board? And you're asking, how do I win the game? And I don't care.
Well,
like,
why am I on the board? Like,
yeah, and that doesn't. I don't have those questions. Mm-hmm. I want to know
I can roll the die and I can move my and I see what happens. The piece moves forward three spaces. Those are the rules of the game, and you can't break the rules until you know the rules. And then once you know the rules, I think science really gives you the ability to say, well, what if we did this thing right at the second where the die is about to hit the table, and we can guarantee you're going to roll a six. And that's the compelling part about me to science is that, like, once I kind of know the rules, there are some rules that can't be broken, but there are other rules, like, we can muscle.
Yeah, you can game the game.
But learning how to play the game is kind of the domain of science. And then, like, what game are we playing and who's playing the game? I don't care. Like, I want to know what the rules are. And are the rules the same for everybody? And that's science kind of says the rules that are the same for everybody, those are scientific. And the rules that are different depending on your mental state or your perception, those are not so scientific.
Okay.
Theists and atheists tend to have competing positions for the origin of the universe, and it often goes something like this. I'll do different voices. No, I won't. Okay. Position A. No one created anything out of nothing, which is the atheist's view. All right, that was wrong. No one created something out of nothing, which is the atheist's view. Or position B, someone created something out of nothing, which is the theistic view. If these views are an accurate representation of the theist and the atheist position, which view is more rational or reasonable and why?
Can I – I just want to think about how A is formulated a little bit, because it seems to me quite plausible that it never happened that something came out of nothing. It seems to me quite a plausible hypothesis. Again, I don't know how we would test this or this is true, but just the universe has always been here in some form or another. Maybe it was a small, dense object before the Big Bang, and maybe there was a big crunch before that. But there was never the case that there was nothing and then something. I mean, theists and atheists can actually agree about that
option
point.
Option C. There you go.
Yeah.
Okay. So there was – then A would make sense. No one created something.
Right.
Out of nothing. I mean, it had to start somewhere. I mean, I believe science has answered that question that there was a beginning to the universe, right?
Well
– measurable.
Sorry. But there's
the universe
the
as
current,
we know
to
it.
To the current universe.
That gets into
– what existed
to the
before.
Best of our knowledge right now, This is what we know to be true. And not capital T true, little t true.
Okay.
A is ambiguous between something came out of nothing and nobody was responsible for it, and it was never the case that something came out of nothing. And I kind of lean towards that second view, though I guess an atheist could take the first view too, that it was never the case that there was nothing. There was just always something.
There was always something. Okay. All right. So the universe in that estimation, the universe would be eternal in some way, shape, or form.
Yes. So the theist.
So the Carl Sagan cosmos. The universe is all there ever has been. You know, has always been. Always. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Got it. All right.
Billions and billions.
Billions and billions.
So let's spend. So any other thoughts on that? Because I know there's a big question that we want to ask. The one that I think atheists probably get the most. So. We're going to kind of do some play acting here.
We're skipping a couple.
We're skipping a couple because you wanted to spend the rest of the show on this.
I was kidding. Moving
are you
on.
Sure? All right. Are you sure? I mean, how much time do we have? I mean,
we got a half hour.
Okay, we're going to spend a half hour on this
all
one.
All right.
Then. So we're gonna jump down to 10. We wanted to ask some questions about human consciousness and deterministic and mechanism. We can get into some of that a little bit in this last question, I think. But Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion, interviewed with radio host Justin Brierley. Here's what was said. I'm going to play Brierley and Kent is going to be Dawkins. So.
Kent, we've met.
All right. So, Brierley, when you make a value judgment, don't you immediately step yourself outside of this evolutionary process and say that the reason this is good is that it's good? And you don't have any way to stand on that statement.
My value judgment itself could come from my evolutionary past.
Is Brierley British? I feel like I'm doing the wrong accent now. All right.
Do a really stereotypical Indian accent.
No.
Okay.
So, therefore, it's just as random in a sense as any product of evolution.
You could say that. Nothing about it makes it more probable that there is anything supernatural.
Ultimately, your belief that rape is wrong is as arbitrary as the fact that you've evolved five fingers rather than six.
You could say that, yes.
All right. So in this interview, Dawkins is considered a consistent materialist. So let's ask a philosophical question here, but I want everyone to get in on this. With this view, do the good things, in air quotes here, and the bad things, also in air quotes, we do have any true objective moral significance? Or does rape and murder have the same moral significance as, say, wearing white after Labor Day? Does evil objectively exist in the atheist worldview, or do you just happen to really not like certain things?
So, rape and murder have much more moral significance than wearing white after Labor Day. Evil objectively exists. I really don't like certain things, but that has nothing to do with what's evil or not. This Dawkins passage is infuriating because he makes so many mistakes. Mistakes that I think he knows better. He may be speaking loosely, but if I can mention three mistakes. First mistake. We don't really – evolution doesn't give us beliefs. Think about my belief that Justin Trudeau is the Prime Minister of Canada. That's not written into my DNA. What evolution gives me is propensities to form beliefs, and then I go out in the world and I respond to the world and I have those beliefs. It seems to be quite scientifically just implausible that rape is wrong is written into Dawkins' DNA. He probably had to learn what rape was to make that judgment. What evolution gave him was propensities to respond to the world. He was put in the world and he formed that judgment. I think he knows that he's just speaking kind of loosely, but that kind of leads him to say things that I think aren't quite right here. Just because a judgment has an evolutionary history doesn't mean it's random or arbitrary. Again, in some sense, evolution explains at least partly why I think Justin Trudeau is the Prime Minister of Canada. But that belief is not random or arbitrary. It's responsive to the world.
Right.
And I'm sure Dawkins' beliefs about rape are the same way, responsive to what's going on in the world. Finally, I just want to distinguish – the third mistake, which – I just want to distinguish between our judgment and the fact. So there's two things. There's a fact about Canada that Justin Trudeau is the prime minister, and there's my belief, which is in my mind brain. Even if my belief were arbitrary, that wouldn't make the fact arbitrary or random. And so even if we could show, and I don't think this is right, that Dawkins' belief that rape is wrong is somehow arbitrary or random, that wouldn't mean that the fact that rape is wrong is arbitrary or random. So three mistakes that Dawkins makes there.
Well, the question that would come from that is, I mean, Justin Trudeau is objectively the Prime Minister of Canada, right?
Indeed.
So if you were to At the time of the recording of this podcast, Justin Trudeau is objectively the Prime Minister of Canada. And if you were to believe otherwise, your belief would not correspond with reality, right? So Justin Trudeau is, in this case, the objective truth, right? And if you do not believe that objective truth, you are wrong, right? But that's an objective reality. Unfortunately, we're talking about beliefs about right and wrong. We're talking about good things and bad things. Is rape just a thing? Ultimately, if there's no rhyme and no reason and no meaning to the universe other than what we grant to it, and then ultimately, it's all just going to wind down and implode on itself, right? Ultimately, is there anything objectively right or wrong other than what we say it is?
I guess the question about rape in particular is, without a conception of sexual mores and morality, is there any difference between rape and any other sort of physical assault?
Yes.
What is it?
You guys are philosophy guys. Come on now. Earn your keep.
Well,
and obviously, anybody listening, I hope we're not triggering. All of us in this room, I do believe, think that rape is objectively wrong, right?
Well,
we're just
wondering
where we get there, how we get there.
Yes. it's kind of my area here. Rape and murder. I know.
That's my area. Yeah. Rape and murder.
He was
murder.
A warden, right? Okay. He dealt with a lot of rapists and murderers.
Yeah, deputy warden, but let's not.
All right, sorry.
And by the way, Gordon Lightfoot is the premier of.
He's the Prime Minister
Prime
of Canada?
Prime Minister of Canada now. It just happened.
Everything I know is wrong.
You can't qualify rape in terms of morality without. You've got to consider the victim. And the way you're talking about it, it's like you're not raping someone because, it's morally wrong. You're not considering the fact that you're causing harm to somebody. Physical harm and discomfort, murder. You're stopping someone from existing. Those aren't moral judgments. That's an actual impact on another person.
Sure. But in a universe that has no meaning and no purpose, that is ultimately going to collapse in on itself anyway, all of us are going to end up in that same place, someone being hastened there. If there's no heaven, no hell, no ultimate judgment, no nothing, does that matter?
Yes.
Now you're going from atheism to nihilism.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Right, right.
There's a very big fatalist streak that goes through a lot of atheist thought, and so that's what I'm getting at.
I think what we're not grappling with is the very idea that we are talking about rape as a type of assault that's different from grabbing somebody's arm and breaking their humerus, in a garden variety assault. That rape is different leads one to the conclusion that there is something about sexual morality or sexual mores that make it different. So where does that come from? Why is rape different?
Outcomes. I'm uncomfortable with this entire line of questioning because
let's come up with a different crime.
Well, it's the same difference between manslaughter and murder. The end result is the same. Assault is assault. Someone is injured in one manner or another. Mm-hmm. In a murder or manslaughter, whatever, it's the same thing. The same end result. The fact that you've given it a name doesn't change the fact that it's still an assault. It's just a different type of assault. You just gave it a different name.
Mm-hmm. It's also – rape is often a gendered crime that contributes to the systemic oppression of women, and that definitely changes things and makes it different from me just assaulting somebody in an ordinary case.
So let's move it to this then. Okay, so – and I think we did this last time we talked about this religion poison everything. Ricky, you were here. I use the example of the Holocaust, right? So the Holocaust happens, right? And we win. America wins, right? And we put the Nazis on trial. At Nuremberg, right? So the Nuremberg trials, and we go and we prosecute them. We prosecute these Nazi guards based on the premise that we know what you did was wrong, and you know what you did was wrong, and you violated what you knew was wrong in order to do these acts, right? Everybody appealed to some sort of objective moral standard in this. Now, if there is not an objective moral standard that you can say where that objective moral standard comes from,
because the Nazis were fulfilling the laws of their country.
Okay.
Okay. No, that's right. What we're saying. They were not acting illegally according to the laws of their government.
Right.
And that's why their defense typically was, I was just following orders.
I was just following orders, right? And so that happened. And what you end up having, though, is if there is no objective moral standard to which we could appeal, while we might have still had to fight the Nazis, our fighting them for killing Jews wouldn't be morally any different than fighting them because the color of their eyes were blue, right? We might have still had to fight them. It might still be the right thing in our estimation. But morally, they would be on the same level, right? It would be completely arbitrary.
Yeah, I'd say this first. I'm not sure why this is really a question about atheism, but I assume there are objective moral standards. Human beings have a dignity, a value beyond price. The Nazis acted in a way that failed to respect that. Theists should agree with me on that. Atheists should agree with me on that.
We do.
Yeah.
But where does it come from?
Right.
Well, so this is another one of these where does it come from hardest problem in philosophy questions, to which I respond – probably, I think, roughly the same thing you do. Imagine that I just prove to you that God does not exist.
Right.
Are you going to murder Travis and blow up three cars and assault 45 children? No. You're probably going to say, you know what? Human beings still have a dignity, a value beyond price, a value that matters objectively, and I need to consider that in the way I
treat them. But at that point, what Dawkins has said makes more sense. The reason why I wouldn't do those things, one, because I'm a black man in America and police just shoot first, ask questions later. But if I'm breaking a crime, they're definitely going to shoot me. Also, there's a social order, right? You know, I might not like my neighbor. I'm not going to go burn down his house because, you know, fences make good neighbors and just want to keep my neighborhood and my property value up and things like that as well. But I'm just a decent human being because I feel like being a decent human being. So do I need religion to necessarily make me a decent human being? No, absolutely not. But what I will say is I think there is a greater impetus for a person who can point to whatever their religious belief is, or their religious belief is, for grounding their moral beliefs in something. I don't know that the atheist has a place to do that. It seems arbitrary for the atheist. It's just I'm doing this because I want to.
And I will say this about the
otherwise
last
you don't
question.
Have to.
Just wanted to say this about the last question. If you suddenly on that terrible, terrible day were able to prove conclusively 100% that God does not exist, my aversion to crime would not be about human dignity. It would be about consequences. I
think you're a better person than that, Kent.
Well, right. You'd think so. but no, it's about it would be about avoidance of negative consequences because
No, you're so much better than that.
I'm flattered. But I just want
to care about people, and you would still care about people.
Guilt is still a negative consequence, though.
You can turn on the news and see that people, by and large, do really terrible things. Now, of course, the news is about selling bad news. They're not going to tell you about all the planes that landed on time, right? They're going to tell you about the one that crashed.
Except that one segment where they But
there are people who do small things, right? Little white lies and, I'm going to fudge a little bit on my taxes because look what the big guy out there is doing. He's screwing over everybody. So what does it matter if I didn't carry the one and I got a little bit extra back on my taxes, right? So I think this idea that, we're decent human beings and even if there weren't a God, we would just do all the right things anyway, I see too much shit, and I've done this show so much and talk with people who give terrible stories all the time. And Rick was a deputy warden. You've seen the worst of the worst. You said something on the show where I'm like, holy shit. So I think that you want to believe the best of people, but I do think that there are those who, if the rules were lifted – yes. All bets are off, and I don't want to say that God is some controlling force because people say that.
But there's a reason
right?
for that that goes well beyond the issue of God, and that comes with social, development, mm-hmm. and brain development, with early intervention. People become criminal for a variety of reasons, and it's not their mom and dad may take them to church every day, but if dad beats them every day, that has a negative impact on their DNA. And their thought processes.
Okay.
Well, and I think what you're getting at, this really dives into what you were talking about earlier. Okay, what are the rules? And I think the rules of the game are something that are commonly accepted. And yeah, there are people that decide they don't accept those rules. You have crime. You have, look at any superhero movie. You have people that live out, that kind of stuff. I don't know that it's necessarily the removal of the rules that would cause issues. I think the removal of enforcement might cause issues. Like if all of a sudden there were no police to be found anywhere, you'd probably have a lot more issues.
Right. Is everybody here saying that you've said that you believe in objective moral standards? Yes. I haven't got that from everybody yet. Does everyone here believe in objective moral standards? And let me define objective. Objective means it is true for all people in all places at all times, and it is independent of what we believe about it. We can transgress it, but it is always true.
I think if that were true, we wouldn't have a lot of the problems that we have.
If objective truth were true, or
if objective truth were true. Like, I still think it comes back to you rationalize after. So the same Christian who would never do something to harm someone else may rationalize it as they're Christian and therefore they do that. But even when atheism was discussed, like how you became atheist, it started with a feeling. Like, I didn't feel that. Like, I think I heard that three times. I didn't feel that. So then it became, well, why don't I feel that? And you figure out, like, okay, well, maybe that doesn't exist and I don't feel it because of that. So it becomes rationalized. Anything is rationalized after. I mean, you don't want to harm someone else. You want to do good things for other people. You don't have to have a reason, but you'll figure out a reason. It's like if you do something nice for some stranger and you're with somebody and they're like, why'd you do that? You're going to give a reason, but that reason, you don't need a reason. You just, something in you led you to do that, led you to do something nice. The same way that some people who would do horrible things would do horrible things no matter what and then rationalize their way out of it after. So they may be, like, they may appear to, I mean, there's been a bunch of serial killers who were supposedly devout Christians. We don't know if they still believed they were that, even, like, despite what they were doing. They might have.
But if we take Dawkins' view, it's kind of like a deterministic view of the universe in a way. Like, we're just the products of our biological impulses, right? Like animals. Like animal, you know, you and me, baby, ain't nothing but mammals, but let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel, right? So we're just the slave to our animal instincts, our impulses. We might just, by even talking about God, having these conversations, we might be doing what the universe has already determined for us to do, right? We have no free will. At least that's how it comes across in a way.
How do you think about time, though?
This is important, I think, because you just brought up, we skipped a step.
We did skip a step.
About human consciousness and how do you conceive of the origin of human consciousness? As an atheist, I ask myself frequently, like, what is divinity? What does it mean to be like God? And if I think about what my conscience, what bends the arc of the universe towards justice? And is the idea that there is a supernatural force who's pushing us closer and closer to his image, or we're formed in that image, why are we not already there? if he knows, or if it knows what that is, why is there all of this pain and suffering? But the origin of consciousness and the origin of that conscience, which is if I do things that harm others, there, it's not just that I feel bad, it's that there is a moral arc to the universe that murder is wrong. If somebody doesn't believe that, or if they haven't had these experiences as a child that haven't led them to the belief that we have that the universe is worth their efforts, it everything starts to unravel. But the existence or non-existence of the origin of that feeling that I have, that I don't want to murder someone, doesn't have to come from outside of the fact that when I get together with other mammalian figures, mm-hmm. that we have good times together, that like I'm a community member in this species, that the innate value of that interaction is enough for me to not want to murder and not want to steal. I don't need there to be consequences.
But if there is enough, and here it's coming back to the question that we skipped a couple questions so we could spend a half hour on it, and I feel we're still not going to get it in. And that is your appreciation of community and the good times that you have in a room with other people makes you feel, you know, good about it, makes you not want to kill. Could you blame somebody who doesn't feel that for coming in and killing us because he wants our stuff? When we do not place that moral stricture on wolves, one wolf wants the female of another werewolf, he'll bite his throat out. And that's the law of nature. That's just the way it is. Nobody gives a shit. So why is it okay for them but not for us?
I would say it's not okay for them. It's just morality applies to beings that are capable of recognizing moral principles and understanding them. So it doesn't make sense to say the wolf acts rightly or wrongly or permissibly. But there's a difference between us and wolves. You can explain this difference scientifically. We're capable of grasping moral principles and regulating our conduct by them, and we do it imperfectly and sometimes poorly. But it's something we're capable of doing, and that's why it makes sense to call what we do wrong.
Well, and let's be clear, because this gets back to, I think, your core question, Calvin, as well as you, what you just asked Kent. Depends on the time and place, where we are in history. At one point in time, it was perfectly acceptable for human beings to act and react that way. To your point, Calvin, I don't know that there is such thing as capital O, capital T, objective truth, or capital O, capital M, objective morality. There is where we are as a society right now and what we collectively agree is right or wrong. 150 years ago, a lot of church-going people did a lot of really bad things to people in the South.
Yeah, like own my ancestors.
Yes. I'm just saying, yes. You know, but that was the objective morality and the objective truth at the time mm-hmm. was that was okay.
Wait, that's what they – I want to bring in this distinction between what you believe and what's true. So they believed that was the objective truth, but they were just wrong.
They were in violation of objective truth.
They were mistaken.
Maybe morality is the norm and immorality is the learned behavior.
How do you know they're wrong? How do we – like how do you put a – for example, how do you take a cannibal out of a tribe that has never had human contact – and put them on trial
they
for cannibalism.
They can't be cannibals with no human contact.
You know, ba-dum-tsh, you know what I mean. With no outside human contact, put it that way. You know, but how do you put them on trial for their
cannibalistic societies without outside contact don't last too long.
Oh yeah, because they eat each other. Got it. I was like, wait, well, oh, got it. There's one guy left and he starves to death.
There's a point to this. There's a point to this. Societies with really, really immoral views don't last. You have to be somewhat moral for your society to last at all.
So at that point, does it get back to Dawkins' point that this is just evolutionary development and not necessarily a, hey, this is actually intrinsically, objectively right or wrong. It's like, what do we do to survive? What do we do to get along? As a matter of fact, so you – Kent, you brought up a wolf biting on another one's throat. Yeah. And Ryan, you're saying, hey, you know what? We have the ability that we're different than wolves. We have the ability to think rationally, to think morally. And Dawkins is like, hey, look, those are just impulses firing in your brain. So in a way, we're really still not different than wolves.
Well, so I mean, if the objective truth is that murder is wrong,
mm-hmm.
someone walks in this room with a gun. Mm-hmm. We all just going to sit here and let it happen?
No, absolutely not. But that's self-preservation.
Would we kill that person with that gun?
I would at least try to disarm him.
I'd use mine.
But that's my point. Well, but that's my point.
Terrific. And I would thank you.
So then murder is wrong is not an objective truth.
No, wait a minute.
It is a situationally objective truth.
Well, if you were defending yourself, then we're talking language. All right.
Well, then it's not murder, by the way.
Right. I mean, definitionally, that's
you're
not
ending
murder.
Another person's life. That's murder.
No, murder is wrongful killing, and not. This is just a pointless semantic thing.
But
has anybody seen Dave Chappelle's like second to last?
Not
most
where
recent?
I expected that
I did.
To go.
I did. Dave Chappelle references are always welcome on this show. Sure. Just so you know.
He constructs a narrative around which there's a superhero who can save lives.
Oh, God.
Only in the case, and I'm not going to
repeat this reference, though.
Let's just assume the superhero has to commit an assault in order to gain a superpower for a short amount of time in order to stop evil forces in the universe. And so the question is that a moral good or a moral bad? If you have to individual on a one-to-one basis cause someone pain in order to save hundreds.
So there's a train rolling down a mountain,
exactly.
And there's a switch, and it's okay. It's
the ends justify the means? Yeah,
that is a level of philosophical pondering I did not expect to show up in a stand-up act.
He is very, very deep.
Okay,
but yeah. Ryan, back to your imploring of Kent. To be better. I would hope you were better. If God just stopped existing, if I proved to you today that God didn't exist, I would hope that you were a better person than to go, okay, all bets off. I'm just going to go do what I want to do, right? I think, and this is where, showing my theist cards, right? This is where I think that I feel atheists borrow from religious thought in order to make that assessment, given that, hey, we don't, you know, our objective, you said you believe in objective moral standards. I don't believe they have to come from somewhere. Whether you believe that or not, I think that the objective reality is Justin Trudeau is the prime minister, right, of Canada. So the objective reality is, at least in Christian thought, that your impetus to not kill, your impetus to not steal, your impetus to not rape, your impetus to do good by your neighbors comes from, although it is somewhat marred at this point, this stamping of that image of God that you were rolling your eyes at a little bit earlier, right? This imago Dei that I know as philosophers you've heard this idea, right? So I think for the Christian, that's our answer for where And Muslims and Jews would also say we're stamped with this image of God in a way. So that question still stands as where do objective moral standards come from for people who believe that the universe is all there ever is, all there ever will be. It's a cold, undirected process. There's no ultimate purpose. Where do objective moral standards come from? Because if there's not something ultimate, it is what Dave said. It is, you know, what do we believe the time? Right? These things change and nothing's – it's all small O, not big O.
So I would say the
– Hmm?
There's an importance here to creation, right? We didn't talk about creation and creation myths and where's the origin of life beyond the universe. But once you have life, I think you can objectively say that life is a creative act, that it creates new potential, and evolution is constantly doing this where there's things that didn't exist before that are being evolved in order to respond to an ever-changing environment. And to stifle that creativity through what I'll call the graveyard of ideas, right? If you never get a chance to test your idea, the idea that's in your head, or you're an organism or a tree or whatever, and you're alive, you're experimenting in the world. And if an external entity to you decides your experiment is over, that's unjust. That's not up to you. It's up to me to decide up until a point, you know, if my body gives out, that's the end of my time. But for someone else to come in and say, your experiments are stupid, we're gonna end this for you. I'm also vehemently opposed to the death penalty, for example.
I was going to say that seems to happen in academia quite frequently. I've seen Ghostbusters. Your experiments are stupid. Get out.
So, that ability to recognize that life is creative, and if I ask what is divinity, I think it is creation. The closest you can get to God is to create something that's never existed before. And say that I made that. That without me, this wouldn't have been possible.
Okay, Dave, small O, not large O. Eitan asking, why does that matter? Why does that matter? I think the existence of big O objective moral standards matters and is not situational. It is not temporarily binding. The reason why objective moral standards need to exist and they need to be grounded somewhere is so that people can recognize them, right? So slavery has always been wrong. We might not have recognized that. But in order to say that slavery is wrong, it must be wrong at all times for all people in all places. Otherwise, people who are enslaved right now, there is no reason for me to be outraged. I can just say, I don't like that thing. I can go fight you over it, but I just don't like that thing. It is big O objectively wrong, whether we realize it or not. It is only, it needs to be big O objectively wrong so that when we recognize it, we are coming in line with reality. Just like the person who, hey, I don't believe Justin Trudeau is the Prime Minister of Canada. Oh, Justin Trudeau is the Prime Minister of Canada. Now your ideas are becoming aligned with reality. So at one point, people believed slavery is right, and it is objectively right. It was objectively wrong while they believed it was objectively right. Now, we can go round and round about how do we start to recognize objective morals. That's a whole other conversation. But in order to call something truly wrong, big O objective moral standards must exist. The question for where they are grounded is different for the atheist and the supernaturalist, but they must exist in order to say that anything is actually objectively wrong and end it. Otherwise, we just all disagree on things.
Why isn't it objective just because we believe it? I mean,
because when you have two competing objective beliefs, I believe slavery is right. I believe slavery is wrong. You have both people who believe they're objectively right.
That's what makes them have the conflict in the first place. They both believe they're objectively correct.
But somebody's wrong.
They don't have any doubt that they're both correct.
But the law of non-contradiction says somebody's wrong.
And
right?
That's why I said that doesn't – oh, we didn't talk about
– somebody's view does not correspond with reality.
That was one of the things that, like, we skipped that. But that was one of the things I was saying. You build your, like, everything is a mental construct. So, like, when you talked about time, when you talked about, like, there, determinism assumes there's a future and a past that you aren't remembering or imagining. It assumes that the present isn't the only real time and that the other ones aren't just in your head. So if you're dependent on this idea that what is right now isn't reality as far as you know, I mean, even without something outside of yourself to tell you to feel guilty for doing something, there's the social responsibility that he talked about, where it's like humans can't live on their own. Like, one human doesn't survive. You need the group. So you're built to, like, have you ever seen the experiments people do where they just have fake paparazzi follow them around?
I've not.
Okay. They will do it, and they'll have, like, somebody say that they were part of something, like just somebody in a crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Loved you in, you know, Aladdin, whatever.
Okay. What's your point?
They start interviewing the people around them. Do you love this guy? You've seen this guy show? Yeah, he was great in Aladdin. They've never seen him before in their life. They want to be part of something, though. It's an automatic, like, people are built to want to be part of groups or to not want to feel left out. Like that, like loneliness. What is loneliness? Loneliness isn't even.
Okay,
like,
so let me stop you there because we are running out of time, and I think the point you're making is somewhat going off the rails, but let me use a little bit of that analogy there. If that happens, if someone's going around with a camera and guy looks famous, you don't know who he is, and then someone comes and interviews you and says, hey, do you love this guy in Aladdin? Oh, yeah, I love that. Okay, at that point, that person's lying. Okay?
Right. I mean, I didn't identify with it, but I was like,
they're lying. They want to be part of a group. That's fine. But you were admitting, at that point, that person is lying, which means that their words and their recognition of that person does not correspond with the reality that person is not, in fact, famous at all. Right? So, again, you were with your own analogy, you were pretty much admitting that there is objective reality. There is objective truth. There is a real right. There is a real wrong. There are real truth. There are real lies.
Otherwise, we don't. Because I could watch that, and it could be a star I don't know about, and you could play the same prank, except the prank would be on me because the person really is someone famous. I just don't know about them. And, I mean, I that's happened to me. Like, I don't know.
Based on your original analogy, though, based on your original analogy, which is what we should keep with so we can end this show, based on your original analogy, the person's not famous. And the people are lying.
I would really like to say a couple of things just because I have read a lot of theist thought. And so asking about objective truth, to me, calls into mind this day of judgment where someone, a godhead, comes and decides, is what you've done good or bad? Someone outside of yourself. And so the idea that it doesn't matter whether I thought what I did was good or not, someone else is making a decision for me based on an objective truth standard that maybe I don't even believe in.
Right.
And so that, to me, is, does objective truth exist outside of God? If you believe in God, is a nonsense question. Because at the end of your life, someone will measure you against this quote-unquote objective standard, which is whatever God would decide for you. And if you don't believe that, why is Kent, you know, why should a Kent figure decide to align himself with an objective truth without consequence, without a day of judgment? That's an interesting, I mean, separate line of inquiry.
Beyond the social contract, honestly.
But the idea of objective truth, outside of two conscious beings that can negotiate that, to me, that's where, if I can't negotiate with God about what's objectively true, his existence loses its interest. I'm much more interested in sitting around and talking to other people about what they think is should be objectively true so that we can form a society and we can make progress. But if it's somehow arbitrary that they were that these objective truths were preordained, I'll go back to Ryan's point that belief in God should have a utility. It should lead me to these objective truths faster than if I don't believe in God. And
is that the case? Are we getting to the objective truth that slavery is wrong faster with religion? Or how did we get to the objective truth that slavery is wrong? What were the preconditions that were required in order to arrive at that objective truth? And that's, to me, a lot more about the scientific method and modern rationalism and figuring out what are evidence-based methods. I think we get to truth, objective truth, faster with science than we do with religion.
Except for that whole social Darwinism thing. That kind of sucked for people of color.
Can I kind of – I just kind of want to push back on the objective morality rooted in God thing. So you asked the where do morals come from question, and I said hardest question in philosophy. Great. There's lots of great theories that atheist philosophers have come up with. I don't know which one is right. But some people say, oh, but there are these theories that say it's rooted in God. Maybe that's the right one. And there's a problem with those theories, which is they're kind of embarrassingly terrible. They'll say things like, well, nothing is right or wrong until God makes it so. So how does God decide what's right or wrong? He can't appeal to what's already right or wrong because there's no right or wrong outside of God. He just makes it up. He picks it arbitrarily. He could have said that rape is great, but he just arbitrarily chose that. And that's a weird theory to give, right? It's also very odd. It makes God weirdly irrational. Like, so there's no objective right or wrong independent of God, but God just cares a lot about these arbitrary things that have no importance. Surely God is not like that. So that theistic theory of where morality comes from is horrible. It's like the worst one I've ever heard. So we should abandon that and go for the great ones that many great atheist philosophers like Kant and Sidgwick and Hume have put forth.
If that were the Christian theological position, yeah, that would be one that you would want to abandon, that God is just completely arbitrarily picking things like, hey, you know what? He could have made this guy purple, or he could have made rape, you know, the order of the day, and he could have made that morally correct. That's just not what we find. What we find, Christian theists, Muslim theists, Jewish theists all find that morality and objective truth comes from the character of God, not that he's choosing something arbitrarily. Now, that's very different. Yeah, so that's very different than just saying, hey, all right, I want this to be good and I want this to be bad, and make it so. Number one, I mean, that's just not how it works in Christian theology. I would agree with you.
Yeah, let me just make a big picture point, and this applies to both the laws of logic and the laws of morality. I think it's tempting to assume, oh, if there's a God, these things are not problematic because we can say God did it. And I just want to point out, that's not the end of the story. We have to ask, what did God do? How did he do it? What's the evidence he did it that way rather than another way? And these stories get complicated and hard. Yep. And so it's a hard question. Where do the laws of logic or the laws of morality come from? The theist has to tell a really complicated, difficult story. And the atheist has to tell a really complicated, difficult story.
I got to deal with a lot of questions about genocide. I'm committed to this Christian conception of God. And there are all these horrible things that happen in the Old
Numbers
Testament
31.
And in the New Testament, right? And so, and then it's been used beyond that to keep people subjugated, to take people's land. I mean, now it's being used incorrectly, but it has been used that way regardless.
Right.
I mean, there was a reason why black people weren't allowed to read. Because if they were able to open the Bible and be able to read, they'd be able to say, hey, slave traders go to hell, right? But they were read all these other verses by their slave masters to keep us docile. And so I have seen how religion has been used poorly. I've seen how the Bible's been used poorly. The Quran's been used poorly. Torah's been used poorly. But even if it's not used poorly, I still, as a theist, have to grapple with, hey, God said go wipe out all these people. Well, shit. Hey, by the way, God didn't even say go wipe out all the people. He's just going to do it for you. He's going to drown everybody. That's one of the worst ways you can possibly die. So these are things that I have to grapple with as a theist. So no, it doesn't make it easy talking about morality just because I believe in God. But that also does not mean that morality for Christians specifically, anybody in the Abrahamic faith, that morality is in fact embedded within the character of God and not just capriciously, arbitrarily, figured out.
To be fair, I think it would be fair to say that in the Great Flood, some people died of causes other than drowning. Mudslides.
Probably. I don't even want to think
collapsing
about it.
Buildings. Okay.
We can continue some of that. We're unfortunately out of time. We can continue this conversation out in the lobby offline. I would love to do – this has probably been the best. Don't tell the other people who are on the other panels. But this has been the best.
I feel like Calvin's the Hooters waitress. Oh, my God. This place was so boring until you guys got here.
Yeah. Whatever you say, lady. Whatever you say. All right. So, but hey, thank you all so much for being here. Thank you for engaging on tough questions. Thank you for for engaging rationally and thoughtfully and being cordial. And also for those of you who are listening, thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure you check out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and the last two seasons, bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com, and we'll get back to you. Don't forget you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and the Podcast Detroit app. Please leave us a review. That's very important. And tune in next week where Kent and I will begin a new series titled Laws of Attraction. We've invited on several people to answer the question, what do women want? See you next week.